Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Norval Feltz is our guest, along with Laura Cantrell, who dropped by the studio. Two fantastic folks in the country genre, king and queen of country music, maybe. Thanks to Matt Lucas, who gave me Norval Feltz's phone number. And he doesn't do email, and he doesn't like to wake up early, so we worked this out, and he turned out to be just a sweet guy. A great part of music, country music history, because, you know, he really recorded at Sun Records, and so he's part of early rockabilly history, and then he also had some huge hits in the 70s and part of that 70s music scene. So I love guys with the sort of two chapters, and the chapter, of course, the other chapter of he hasn't quit yet. And just a humble guy, he sent me a couple of letters and a Christmas card, handwritten stuff. And his return address, by the way, is Norval Feltz Lane, which I think is great. So first we're going to hear from Norval Feltz, and then Laura Cantrell dropped by and brought her guitar and played us a few songs on her way to a gig in New Jersey. And Laura is one of my favorites, so happy that she could join us. So we're going to hear from two great folks. Don't forget Ronnie Hawkins coming up. A few other things. Check WFMU.org/Michael to keep yourself updated of who's coming up on the program. Let's start off with Norval Feltz and then stay tuned for Laura Cantrell. All right, there is Foolish Thoughts, 1957, from Norval Feltz. And Norval joins us. Good morning. Now, I hear you that usually you do not like to wake up before 12 noon. Is that correct?
A little before then, but it's early afternoon by the time I get myself going, you know.
Is that just a residue from just being a touring musician for all these years?
Well, I guess it probably is. But Loretta and I, my wife, have kind of gotten a habit of sleeping late and going to bed late.
Yeah, well, that's your night owl, I guess. So you have charted records in 5 decades. You have been making music a super long time. We just heard Foolish Thoughts. Do you ever listen back to those super, super old records?
Well, sometimes I do. Every now and then I will get one out and put it in my car or my van if I'm taking a trip and listen to one of them.
They still sound great, and they sound, you and I were talking about this earlier, they sound sort of organic. You know, there's a wonderful, it just sounds like a bunch of guys in a room playing, which is what I imagine it was.
It was, yes, especially, you know, when we first went down to Sun Records and did 10 sides for them on 2 different sessions. And then a couple of months later, I got a chance to go to Chicago and record for Mercury Records, and we did some of the same songs again at Mercury.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of hear the contrast between those two different versions of some of the songs. So you're born, I believe, in Arkansas, but you grew up mostly in Missouri, in a farming town. Is that right?
That's right. I was born in Arkansas, near Keyser, Arkansas. And at the time I was born, my daddy was a sharecropper. And him and Mama worked really hard and saved their money. Mama got a job in a store in Keyser, and they bought a little 40-acre farm in Missouri, and when I was 14, we moved to the little community of Poe near Burney, Missouri, and Burney is where I went to high school.
So was your life going to high school and helping out on the farm?
Yes. I would, you know, chop cotton in the summer and pick cotton. There would be a cotton vacation. In those days, the school would let out for 6 weeks for the kids to pick cotton.
Oh, because all the kids were farmers' kids?
Mostly, yeah. It was farming community.
Were your parents able to make a go at the farm? Were they successful?
Yeah, they were. They made a comfortable living out of it.
Oh, that's nice. Was there music on the farm? Was there radio? Did your folks play instruments?
Well, my daddy played a harmonica, and he played it real bluesy, sitting around the house. And Mama, before electricity came along, we had a battery radio, and Mama would always listen to the country shows on and not keep the radio on all time. And so I grew up hearing Ernest Tubb and Floyd Tillman and people like that. And then when electricity came along, then the radio would be on a lot more.
And did you get a guitar at a certain point? Was that your first instrument?
Yes, I traded my BB gun when I was 14 years old to a friend of mine, Wayne Grubbs, for an old beat-up Gene Autry guitar that the neck had been broken off of it and had been put back on with some baling wire and a Prince Albert tobacco can. And the neck was really bowed, but I could chord it up to about the A fret. And so I learned my first basic chords on that. And when we got up to Missouri, I picked cotton that fall of 53 and ordered a guitar from Sears and Roebuck and then learned to play it.
So this would have been before Elvis, before really the term rockabilly or rock and roll certainly had been coined, right? I mean, this was straight country music you were influenced by, right?
Yes, that's right. The first song that I learned to accompany myself on guitar and sing the song all the way through was Caribbean by Mitchell Torok.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Kind of a dramatic number there. So soon enough, rock and roll does come along just a couple of years later. Do you remember the very, very first time you heard a song that you would not consider country, something like Elvis? Or what did you hear and how did you hear it?
Well, I started hearing Elvis as soon as he started releasing records because the country stations and the country shows always played Elvis. You know, That's All Right Mama and Blue Moon of Kentucky, and I loved all of his records, and I would learn all of them when they came along.
Did you think there was something different? I mean, did you say, hey, this guy's not just a regular country artist? Did you pick up right away that this was something, you know, maybe new?
Well, I guess I probably did. And then when I was 16 and Baby Let's Play House was a hit in the summer of 55, I was hearing it on all the country radio shows. And then you could go into a little place and the jukeboxes playing and seeing the effect that had on the girls. So that made me want to do that. And also that summer was the first time I heard Maybelline. My sister and I were driving through Paragould, Arkansas, and her 51 Ford and Maybelline came on the radio, and I had never heard anything with a beat like that. And I thought, well, that sounds like a hillbilly that's made him a rock and roll record. And I think a lot of people thought Chuck Berry was country at that time, before the publicity and before you saw his pictures. What a great artist and great writer and guitar player and singer he was.
Oh, absolutely. And you ended up covering Maybelline just soon after that. So it's interesting what your influences were to come from that, you know, on the farm battery operated radio and the country stations that I'm imagining were being played there. And then, quickly to jump from Elvis and into Elvis and Chuck Berry. And so then the girls come in. So you're motivated to learn these songs. And the story is that somebody saw you at a talent show at a local high school. And pretty soon you were on the radio locally. And then somebody and then somebody had a connection and took you down to Sun Records. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I entered a high school talent contest in Burning, Missouri, and I sung Baby Let's Play House, and then it went over really good, and they wanted an encore, and there was this new song I had heard a few times by Carl Perkins. This was very early 1956, and so I sung Blue Suede Shoes, and there was, by chance, was a disc jockey from KDEX in Dexter. In the audience, Weldon Grimsley was his name. And so he came back and met us at the end of the show. And he had me to sing, into his tape recorder and do a song. And so I was naive enough to think that they might play that on the radio the next day. So I was listening to the radio, but it said, if Narvel Phelps is listening, please contact KDEX immediately. And so I ran outside. It was still cold winter time, and told my daddy what they had said on the radio. And so we were poor, and he didn't have antifreeze in his truck, so he would drain the water out, you know, when it wasn't running it to keep it from freezing. So he got up under it and tightened the radiator and pumped water out of the hand pump and put water in the radiator and drove. He had a green 46 International truck. And he drove me the 8 miles out the gravel road from Poe to Burney, Missouri, to the nearest payphone. And I called the radio station, and they said, bring your guitar and come on up. And so I did, and took my buddy J.W. Grubbs with me. And the station manager, we did a song for him, and he said, take him on in and put him on the air. And so that's how that started.
Amazing. So you didn't have the nearest phone to your house was 8 miles away. That is.
Yes, and it was a payphone in Burney.
That's incredible. So you get down to Sun Records, and I know that you worked with Jack Clement, who passed away not too long ago. He was kind of a legendary guy, a songwriter, a guy who was kind of, you know, a key figure in the early days of Sun, and worked with a lot of folks down there. Tell me, what did he bring? Did he have advice for you, or did he? I mean, you guys were
just a bunch
of kids.
First of all, a guy named Jerry Mercer hired me in his band as a featured vocalist, and I also had to play upright bass for him. And I had to learn to play that in order to be in his band, so I did enough to get by. So we did a show on top of the concession stand at the drive-in theater in Dexter, Missouri, and it was with Roy Orbison and the Teen Kings, and Eddie Bond and the Stompers. So without me asking him to, Roy went back to Memphis and told them they should give me a listen. And sure enough, in a couple of weeks, I got an audition with Sun. And it was still hot summertime. That show was August of 56. And we drove down Leon Barnett, the lead guitarist in the band, and I drove down to Memphis and had to go into a city and find our way around and go to Sun Records, which was kind of a exciting but scary a thought at the time. And so we went in and did a few songs for Jack, and he gave us some advice and said, well, go home and write some more songs and get the whole band together and come back and we'll see what we can come up with. And so by the time we got it all worked out, it was January of 57 to go in for the first session. And I believe Foolish Thoughts probably came from that first session.
Yeah, I think you're right. So you did record all these tracks there in Sun Studios in 1957, but none of them came out until later. Why didn't Sun release those records? Were they just too busy with their big stars to kind of break somebody new?
When we did the second session and we had recorded 10 songs with them, Jack said, well, I think we got a record here, but it may take about a year to get around to releasing it. We got so many in front of it. And prior to that session, in early April 5th, 1957, the first week of March of 57, we had played the Fox Theater in St. Louis, which is a big, beautiful theater, with the movie Rock Pretty Baby. We'd do a bunch of shows a day, and they'd play Rock Pretty Baby a bunch of times a day. And so there were some people with connections to Mercury Records approached me there and said, why don't you let me take you to Chicago and get you on Mercury Records? So I said, well, we owe Sun another session. It was coming up in about a month. So about a month after that, I was booked in Litchfield, Illinois, in another theater with another rock and roll movie. And the same man, Fred Varney, came up there and said, well, you've got Monday off. And this was a Saturday night. Said, why don't you let me take you to Chicago and get you on Mercury Records? And so after Jack had told us it may take a year and they didn't ask us to sign a contract, I took him up on it. So we went up to Chicago, and he just went up and into the unannounced to the office at 35 East Wacker Drive, and they were saying, what do you mean bringing a band in here, no appointment? And but Art Talmadge agreed to listen to a song or two. And so we brought our equipment up and set it up in the office, and Art Talmadge came over and stood. I had kind of sung in his ear as a microphone. And we did a couple of songs, and he said, send them on down to Universal and do 12 original songs. And so we went down and we actually wound up doing 10 songs that day. Then at the end of the day, they had a recording contract for me to sign. And then in a month, the first record was out, and I was hearing it on the radio.
Mm. Amazing. Let me remind folks that Norville Feltz is our guest this morning. Your memory is amazing. It's better than mine. So was there like a tangible feeling that people were scared of rock and roll or were not understanding it, or, you know, just the way sort of, you know, 15 years later, kids, people were the next generation ahead didn't like the hippies, or, you know, didn't understand the hippie music or didn't want to accept it. Was there that feeling from the older generation towards you guys?
Well, there was some of it was that way. When I first got a job with Jerry Mercer, and we was going around, and he would opening with Jack and Jill Boogie and Boogie Woogie Country Girl and stuff like that. And then he'd call on me, and I'd sing Ooby Doobie or Bebopalula or something. And we were booked to play a homecoming at a little community of Glennonville, Missouri. Jerry didn't warn me of this, but when we went in that night, rather than singing one of those songs, he opened with Hank Williams' Hey Good Lookin' and stood very still. And then he got Leon, our guitar player, which is a great guitar player. He got his fiddle out, and they played a broom dance. And then he said, now here's Norville Feltz to do you a couple of songs. And I did Ooby Doobie and Bebopalula. And this real red-faced guy came to the stage, and had pulled Jerry over to the edge of the stage, and Jerry called me over, and he said, they don't want you in here. And they kicked me out of the pavilion. I had to stay out and sit on the carpenter the rest of the night.
Where does that intolerance come from? What is that about? Any insight into that?
I don't know. The guy made the statement, which I can't repeat on the radio, of what he said, and so they didn't want any part of me. They didn't like me, and so I was feeling rather down the rest of that night. I just got a job and wasn't happy to chop cotton, you know, and I thought, uh-oh, that's all of it for me. I'll be back in the cotton field. And But that's an illustration of how things did happen in some places, even often little rural areas like where I was at the time.
Yeah. So you're torn around and you're working these singles on Mercury, etc. And I know that there is this strange, a huge scene up in Canada for guys playing rockabilly. Where did that come from? And, I mean, tell me what it was like and how was it different than the similar touring in the United States?
Well, Conway Twitty was a friend of mine and had been at my first session in Memphis and had come out to our house at Poe and had dinner with us. And he was the first to go up and play. He kind of pioneered that Canadian show club circuit. And then he recommended Ronnie Hawkins, and he recommended me. And so I went up I started out 1959 there, and Ronnie Hawkins had already been through the circuit once, and everybody was loving him. And Conway had already had its only make-believe and was a big star, and so he was out of there. So we wound up going on over really good in that circuit, and I spent the majority of 1959 and 1960 in that circuit. And it was really a good circuit. There was one club in Toronto, the Le Coq d'Or, and there was the Edison Hotel on one side of it and the Brown Derby on the other side, all in the same block there. And there would be someone at each of those clubs. And the Brown Derby, I was held over for about 2 months in the summer of 59. And during that 2 months, Bo Diddley was in the Edison Hotel for a couple of weeks. Dwayne Eddy was there for a couple of weeks. Link Ray was there for a couple of weeks. And the Four Lovers were at the Brown Derby, and a few years later, they became the Four Seasons.
Mm. Sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And so that's kind of how that circuit was. It was 5 hours a night, no dancing. So you had to put on a show to keep their attention.
So you're torn around, and you're working in Canada, etc., and you end up working with a bunch of different labels, including Pink and Starline, a few little one-offs here and there. I also noticed in the 60s, there's some footage of you on the internet of you on the Porter Wagner TV show. And I think you also had your own TV show for a while, 1965 Out of Arkansas. Is that right?
Yes. In 64 and 65, I had my own TV show on Channel 8 out of Jonesboro, Arkansas.
What was the format of that?
They called it the Narvel Phelps Show, and I just sung songs for 30 minutes and talked to them and let each of the guys do a song on the show.
Is there any video of that anywhere? Can we see that?
No, sadly there's not. I contacted them after I started realizing that might be important, and they used the same tape over and over back then.
Oh, gotcha, yeah. One of my favorites from this time is this song called Dee Dee. It's kind of like a Cajun song, 1967, and it has a little bit of like a 60s grooviness to it. I mean, you listen to your singles from this time, this is just before your career sort of became a second chapter, but like a little bit of Soap, also on the High Label, 1972, and you can see that you're kind of searching for maybe the next thing, because rockabilly clearly over by the late 60s, early 70s, but I you sort of, the phrase I keep reading over and over again was that your career didn't start until you thought it was over. So your career is just about to have a second chapter. But at that point, you know, 1971, 72, what were you thinking? I mean, what were the rockabilly guys thinking? You know, did you think it was really over?
Well, at first, by that period of time, I thought that if there's a hit record in Narvel Phelps's future, it's going to have to be in the country market. And so I started aiming at country radio. First of all, I recorded a straight country record, which I thought that's what I should do. And nobody played it. Nobody liked it. And then I realized that a lot of my rockabilly records along the way got country play. And so I started doing songs. I did a little bit of soap, and, you know, with a steel guitar on it and like that. And it got a lot of play all over the nation. Different important stations played it some. And then I signed with Cinnamon Records. And so then Bill Rice produced Drift Away on me. And it was became a country smash and went all the way to 4 in Record World, 5 in Cashbox, 8 in Billboard. And that set up my country hit streak. And big records then lasted throughout the 70s. And I kept charting in Billboard up until 87 and Cashbox on up to 93 in the country charts.
Yeah, I think that if I got my research right, Drift Away was your first of 20 top 40 hits in the country charts. I think 42 in the top 100, but 20 in the top 40 is a lot of singles to place into the country charts. A great idea to sort of take an R&B hit and do a country thing, country arrangement on it, and that sort of became your pattern for a while. You'd pick these great songs that you could sing the heck out of, and that's just what you'd do. Your voice around this time started to change. Was it sort of a natural thing? Was it something you'd been practicing? Was it something that came with age? You know, you're a little more intense and going a little more higher, and kind of there's more drama to it.
Well, I think that this came with the times and with what I was doing. And, of course, it fired me up when Drift Away became a hit. And I was driving across the country, regardless of where it was, and I'd hear it myself on the radio 4 or 5 times wherever I'd go. That inspired me, and I guess I sang with more feeling. And we looked, for the songs. And about every other record through all of that period of time would be an original song, a great song. And it would be a hit. So I had big records in between all of those covers that I did. But people mostly remember the Lonely Teardrops and the Drift Away and those songs.
You ended up from Cinnamon going, I think, to Dot, and then you had what's your biggest hit? It's a cover of the Johnny Adams song, Reconsider Me, which is totally, you make that song your own. And that was just a giant hit. 1975, it's an interesting time for country music. And you're a huge part of what was going on. What was the 70s mainstream country music scene like? And what was it like being a part of that?
Well, I was really honored to be a part of it. And it seems strange being on, going out and doing touring with Dolly Parton and people like that, Tammy Wynette, the Statler Brothers, and Kitty Wells. It was very strange that when I became a big artist and was happening and having hit records at the time, that some of my friends, like Carl Perkins, I had first worked with Carl in around 1959 or 60 with us opening for him. And then in the 60s, he worked some shows with me, with just me and my trio backing him. And he was on my TV show. And then in the 70s, he opened some shows for me. That seemed very strange. And one time we was in somewhere in one of the Carolinas, and before the show, I went and I talked to Carl, and I said, "This just don't feel right to me. It should be the other way around." He said, "Well, son, you're the one with the hits now, and you're the one they paid their money to see. You go on out there and you do your thing."
It sounds like you're a super nice guy. Did that niceness ever get in the way of your ambition?
Well, it may have. I think sometimes the people that are more firm and pushy achieve higher things.
Interesting. Well, one of the things I noticed looking at your at all these different records and some of these CDs you were kind enough to send over to me, and that's kind of a nice thing to have so much of your music for, you know, six decades still easy to get for people who are interested, is that you recorded at Royal Studios in Memphis and at RCA Studio B in Nashville and Sun Studios in Memphis and up in Muscle Shoals. You kind of were at a lot of the sort of famous great studios of you know, for recording rock and roll music.
Yes, I was, and six of my hit country albums were recorded in Muscle Shoals. The first song I recorded in Muscle Shoals was Reconsider Me.
I would call the next chapter in your life, it's kind of an interesting the way this turned, is after all these, 20 top 40 hits, all of a sudden the 1980s come, and all of a sudden interest in the rockabilly stuff starts bubbling up again. When did you first, I assume you had written that chapter of your life off completely. When did you first sort of get word that there might be, you know, some interest in performing the old rockabilly tunes again?
The first time I had ever heard about something going on, I got a letter from a man in Germany, a guy named Wolfgang March, and he said, I have your son recording. This was in 1976, I believe. It could have been 75. Of my babe, is there anything earlier by you? I wrote him a letter back, and I said, I didn't know that was ever released. If you'll send me a copy, I'll send you a copy of my latest album. And so that would have been 1976, because my current album was Doing What I Feel on ABC Dot at the time. And so I sent him that album, and he sent me, and it was a various artist vinyl album, Carl Perkins and Hayden Thompson and different people like that on it that had recorded at Sun, and including My Babe by Me from Sun. And the first time I ever, when I went over to Wembley to do the country festival in 74 in London, and it was a big country show with George Jones and Tammy Wynette and just a lot of people. It seemed odd, all of us riding over on the same plane together. And there were some people that kept coming up to me and asking me questions. But all they wanted to know about was recording at Sun and rockabilly and stuff like that. And I thought that was very strange, you know, because I thought that didn't happen, and it's history. Then in 1986, I got a call from England wanting me to come to Cardiff, Wales, and headline what they called a rock and roll festival, a 50s rock and roll festival. And so I thought, well, okay, Johnny B. Goode, Great Balls of Fire. No. We want you to sing your own songs. And I thought, well, that's very strange. Nobody ever heard them.
So at this point, did you have to go back and relearn your own old songs?
Yes, I did. My son was traveling with me then and playing drums. And so he and I got back, got all those old records out. And they sent me a list of my records that they wanted me to sing. And so we learned them all. It's like the old records. And we got there, and they had a band. We had a rehearsal, and the band, that's what was in them. They played like we played in 1956. And to try to go beyond that, it wasn't there for them. But went out there that night and did that show, and it was like going back 30 years. And I was this much older, but the audience looked the same as it did back then, all with ducktail haircuts and the girls with the, you know, poodle skirts and dressed like the 50s. And when the show was over, I left the stage and went back to the dressing room. They just kept on hollering more and more and more and stomping the floor. And so finally I said, well, I don't have anything else prepared. They want me to come do an encore. Well, just go out there and sing a song. But the encore wound up lasting as long as the show did. They just kept on.
That's great.
So I realized that there's something here. And my son did, too. He came back home and went and got my Gene Vincent and Jerry Lee Lewis albums out and took them back to his room, started playing them, and became a great rockabilly drummer. And sadly, we lost him in a car accident in 95. But he loved doing those shows.
Your son,
and,
Bub.
Yeah, my son, Bub.
Yeah, that's true. You do have two kids, right?
Yeah, we have a daughter, Stacia, and she still lives here in Malden, Missouri, the same town we live in.
And you've been married to your wife, Loretta, for how long?
55 years.
Well, one of the great things about starting your career at such, you know, when you were a teenager is that you're still relatively young, and I know you're still out there, and you're still sort of balancing these two groups of fans, these rabid rockabilly fans, because I know that that's only grown in the years since that story you just told. And then also there's those fans of those great hits of yours, those huge country hits. And I know that you can still sing. And you sent me your most recent album called Now Is the Hour. And folks, you're still making music, still writing songs, still doing shows when you can. What are you doing on days when you're not working? What do you like to do?
Well, when I'm not working, I just like staying at home with Loretta. And about all I do is go to the grocery store when we need to go. But I still do enough shows each year that I've got to, I have to keep myself in shape to do them. And I have to sing the songs and get used to doing what I'm going to do on the show. Before I go do it. And I still go do, I went to England in May of this year and headlined the Hemsby Rock and Roll Weekender.
Have you ever had any formal voice training? Did anyone ever, teach you how to sing? Or is it just completely a natural thing for you? Because your voice is startling.
Well, thank you so much. You know, it's natural. I've never had any voice lessons. I probably should have had. But I realize after hearing the new CD that I just released this past year of new recordings, my voice sounds different than it did, back in my hit streak era.
Well, certainly.
But I can still sing and stay on key. I saw that, too, from that.
Well, that's important. Well, Norval Feltz, I've really enjoyed this. Such an interesting story. And, it's the story of more than one chapters of the music business. And that's always amazing when someone's able to straddle two different eras and then keep going, to keep going and never... Never stop is amazing. I wish you luck. And is the best website folks can check up on you? Is it mkoc.com/Norval Feltz?
Yes, that's my official website, and I do have a webmaster that that takes care of that for me. And I usually send her something after every show I do, and a little personal review of it, and call it News from Norval. And sometimes I'm a little slow at getting them to her anymore. I'm not as prompt as I was at one time.
Yeah, folks can check there for updates on what you're doing and where you're doing it and records to buy and stuff like that. And I'll say it again, it's mkoc.com/Norval Feltz. And there's a link to that on the playlist for today's show. You can find that at wfmu.org/Michael. Let's close with Drift Away, just the song that sort of started the second chapter in your life. It has the background vocals are very much of the time, and the arrangement, it's all very 1973. Who picked this song? Was it, did you pick it?
Oh, it was Bill Rice.
Bill Rice, the producer.
Bill, that was the first record he produced on me. Hmm. And him and Jerry Foster were really hot at the time as songwriters. They were writing a lot of country hits. So when I went into his office that afternoon, I had a 6 o'clock session. And that particular session was at Monument Studio in Nashville. And Bill said, well, here's what I think we should do. And he sung Drift Away. And I had only heard the song one time. I had played in Charleston, South Carolina, the Saturday night prior to that. And I had heard it on the jukebox, the Dobie Gray record, which was a hit at the time. And I said, well, you know, I thought I was coming to Nashville to cut a country record. And that sounds like all that stuff I've been doing in Memphis. And don't we need an up-tempo song? Wouldn't we come nearer getting play on country radio with an up-tempo song with all of the ballad artists they have to play? And so he thought for a minute, and he started strumming his guitar, the tempo that my recording of Drift Away is, and did it that way. And so that's how we recorded it that night.
Am I right? The song's written by Paul Williams' brother?
Yes, Mentor Williams.
Mentor Williams, yeah. And it became sort of a classic, just what sort of the world needed, a country version of Drift Away. Well, I wish you a lot of luck, and I thank you for visiting with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate you having me on your show, and I've enjoyed talking with you. And good luck to you, sir.
Day after day, I'm more confused. I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Beginning to think that I'm wasting time. I don't understand the things I do. The world outside looks so unkind. I'm counting on you.
Graham Gouldman will be a guest on Todophonic Todd's show this afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m., who co-wrote that song, of course. And there's a very interesting history of how the 10cc version was recorded, and there's some videos on it, so worth seeking out. Okay, Laura Cantrell is here. Laura, how are you?
Hey, Michael, I'm great.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you, as some listeners have pointed out to me already, you used to be on WFMU right in this time
at
slot.
At this moment. Yes. It feels very strange.
You hosted a program called The Radio Thrift Shop for how many years?
Oh, 13.
It's a lot of trips from Brooklyn, isn't it?
It is.
I know you were disappointed when you had to end the show to become a superstar musician.
Oh, right.
But I knew you had mixed feelings.
Oh, sure.
But in some way, you must be happy not to, you know, just Saturday mornings.
Oh, I still miss Radio Thrift Shop for sure. It was complicated. I was pregnant. I had a record out. I was traveling a lot. So it wasn't just one thing that, you know, that made it not easy to be here on Saturday afternoons anymore, but I don't ever fail to miss you know, doing a show and miss the FMU community and
Well, you're still part
stuff.
Of the family, and you're still on like the air once in a while.
Yeah, I do what I can.
It also gives you an excuse to buy records, listen to records, you know, find music, even if it's not buying, just to seek out. You have to, because my show, you know. At least that's the excuse I use.
It's weird. It's very hard to let go of that sort of thing of curating. You know, think, oh, this record would go really good with that other record. Yeah. You know, it's hard to let go of that mindset, even if you don't have an outlet for it.
Well,
so.
One way I think that the doing a radio show for all those years served you so well was when it came time to pick cover songs, you had more than other people had listened to records.
True.
And on a deeper level, you had done all this work, so you knew a lot of great songs, some that people didn't know, some that people did know.
You know, and sometimes I would actually, I'd be playing something on the air, and humming along in the studio myself, and that song would be a song I'd end up trying to cover. And that was just, you know, the impulse, like, to play stuff on the air and then to learn it for my own, maybe to play it, you know, in my set wasn't that far apart, I don't think, sometimes. So
interesting. Yeah, well, a good song's a good song.
A good song's a good song.
Yeah, I find that to be, sometimes there'll be a record, and it won't be until I actually play it on the air once that I kind of have given it the seal of approval. It's like, that is a kind of a bar. That once it's actually been played on the air, okay, that's a number one hit record right there.
There you go.
Tonight, a gig in Hopewell, New Jersey. We were just talking about this off the air. I've lived in New Jersey now. I was talking to my wife about this. I was writing an imaginary letter to the manager of Whole Foods this week.
Oh, my.
And I started thinking, I have shopped at your store for 15 years. And I thought, wow, I've lived in New Jersey now for 15 years. That seems ridiculous. I've been going to the same store for 15 years. I mean, that's such a long time. But I still don't know where Hopewell is. That's where I'm going with this. But that's where you're playing tonight.
So. That's right. It's a little south of here. And it's not that far. It's like an hour, little plus an hour from here in
And I was looking
Jersey
on
City.
On the web site of this theater that you're playing, and it seems like a lovely little perfect intimate space. Tables and chairs, very adult.
Yeah, grown up.
No mosh pit.
Yeah, it's not a stinky rock club, that's for sure. But
and you've had your share of all of the above. Yeah.
Absolutely. So no, we're looking forward to playing it. I think it's maybe in a sort of it's not in its first season, I don't think, but it's still a relatively newly opened place that they're doing lots of cool stuff with films and a music series. So I was really excited to get asked to play.
There's a link on the playlist for today's program to your website, and on your website there's a link to the theater.
That's right. You have to. It's about three clicks away.
It's so, like a name of a song.
Yes.
Six blocks away. You've opened for a lot of people. You've headlined a lot. You've been to Europe how many times to play music?
I don't know off the top of
my head.
10
times maybe.
Yeah,
right?
At least 10 times.
So I always find that it's kind of a good challenge of your job, is that you walk in and you don't know. You could be a performing arts center with carpeting and lots of bottled juices and things. Or it could be the place where X played last night, or
right.
You know, the punk rock place, and they don't do it. And here's your case of beer, and you don't want to touch the towel.
Yeah,
you know?
No, exactly. It's definitely, you love rooms that people like to hear music in, ultimately, and whether that's like a theater where everybody's got like a relatively comfortable seat, or a place that when you walk in might seem like at 5 in the afternoon when no one's there, like, God, what is this place? And then when it fills up with people, you realize, oh, this is where people like to come to hear music. And,
yeah.
And it's just that place in that town that is
it,
that.
I think
so.
As you do it more, I'm guessing you become more astute at just kind of gauging the vibe and knowing what kind of set to do or what the energy to push back at it is, you know, because you... It's so important to kind of have a two-way relationship with the audience.
That's true, definitely. Yeah, I mean, you hope that you get that. I mean, some days you may not be at your best.
Well, that's what's amazing, though. One day you go out there and nothing, you know.
Right.
It's like comedians say, you tell the same joke the same way two nights in a row, and one night people laugh, one night they don't laugh. It's the same way with music, just nothing some nights, especially when you're the opener. Some people are in some cities, everyone's cool, and then the next night people just are loving you, and you sell a million CDs, and it's hard to put your finger on it exactly, so all you can do is go ahead and do your best.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've done this also, Michael, but you know, sometimes when you go and play in a different country, they're, you know, they don't, unlike New Yorkers, maybe they don't talk through the whole show. So you have no idea. And sometimes you're like, like, is anyone alive out there? And then after the show, you get these such warm, like, quiet, appreciative comments, and you're like, wow, it's just a totally different custom here that people don't express themselves out loud.
You're from Brooklyn. You live in Queens, right? Yeah. But, you know, growing up playing your first shows in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, Queens, people in New York, audiences here are in some ways worse than anywhere. Everyone gets in free.
Right.
And you know, everyone's seen 80 billion shows. Everyone comes through town. But when you go somewhere where people don't come, where there's not 100 bands 7 nights a week to see, and some good ones, you know, they're real happy to see you, and they don't talk, and they're not on the guest list, and they don't have some other better place to be later, or get this, you know, Thai food that they need to, you know, it's just, they're there to see you. Yeah.
I know. It's funny. We did get to go to Spain and Ireland earlier this year, and I love, first of all, just the chance to get to go either place. You just feel lucky to get to go and play music and have that experience. But, you know, it is interesting, you know, both super great music cultures and places where people love to see music. But I think they have a tendency to, like, if you invite them to burst into song with you in Ireland, they'll usually take the bait.
Wow.
So
becomes a soccer chant.
Not quite, but you know.
Oh, really?
It can be. Yeah. So I had just actually done the Irish Rock Review here for St. Patrick's Day. They'd asked me to learn a traditional Irish song. So I was like, I'm going to try this out in Dublin and see if we can get anybody to sing along with us. And sure enough, it didn't take even like half a suggestion for everyone to just like jump right in.
Well, we've been talking about this on this show recently. Oftentimes I'll see a band and people will do things like a sing-along or some things that I would consider the most cliched, hackneyed thing. And I'll be wrong because the audience will eat that up. And,
right.
You know, we talked about this on the show recently. I went to go see the Zombies and they played the song, Argent song, Hold Your Head Up, which is not the worst song in the world, but like the 8-minute live version when you know, boy, I could be hearing three Zombies songs here, but we're going to hear this with the long, long sing-along part. But the audience was going, everybody was singing, Hold Your Head Up, except me and Jordan and Juniper, who were like, you know,
You're looking at your watch going, oh, God, that's another Zombie song I don't get to hear.
So I'm wrong about, like, people love it.
I think people love to sing together. And, you know, we don't all, like, do it in school or church or whatever anymore, or wherever we used to do things like that. You know, how many Christmas carolers do you know? And so, I mean, but I think people still love the experience of it. So, you know, when you give them an excuse to do it, I think it can be a good thing, Michael. Well,
I remember, I don't know, my daughter was in the choir in, you know, third grade or fourth grade or whatever, way back. And I remember going to see the performance and just being very emotional, partly because it's your daughter, but partly I realized it was like, you know, there's the fat kid and there's the skinny kid and there's like, you know, and there's the wiping the nose kid.
Right.
But they're all singing, you know, and there's just something so moving about seeing a person
absolutely
going up there and just singing, good, bad, whatever. They're doing it for you. And this is why people love music, you know?
Right?
Because it's this really direct communication with other people. And same thing in the Low Straitjacket show last night. It's just like, wow, human beings. You know, here they are. They got in a car. They practice. They put on masks. They're up there doing something. Just even like it or not, it's just you. For me, I need that. I need people doing something. You know, that's what I always say about this radio station. Some of my favorite shows here are just the ones where people are trying to cook something up, you know? Just
right.
Whatever it is, like, that's, we need that. I think it's time for you to play a song.
Okay.
Wow, that was
sure.
Long.
Sure. Well, Michael, we could go on.
What is this?
I just was in Nashville, and I was working on some writing, and...
With people.
It's still, you know, that's still kind of can be an awkward thing sometimes. It's kind of like... going on a blind date or something, well, you like writing with people.
I talked to Nick Lowe. He says he's going to Nashville to write with people regularly. And he said some people, I think he said Dan Auerbach insists that nobody, that you bring nothing.
Right.
You just stare at each other until somebody breaks out in a sweat or a song. And then other people say you must bring at least one line or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. But
There are different ways.
So who'd you write this with?
I wrote this with Mark Winchester, who is a bass player in Nashville. He is in the Planet Rockers, which is a very well-known, like going back to the 80s, rockabilly band. One of the first bands that was sort of back out playing on Music Row before BR549 and all the kind of hipsters came and reclaimed Broadway. The Planet Rockers were doing that back in the late 80s, and Mark ended up in Brian Setzer's band for a long time, still does the European touring with Brian Setzer Orchestra. So he's got it, you know, he knows his rockabilly and his... So when you said up-tempo, play me something up-tempo, I thought maybe we'll try this.
This is a brand new song.
Brand new song. And I may really mess it up. In a minute.
I can't be your confidant. I can't be your long-lost pal. But if I'm not the one you want, just tell me so right now. I can't say if this won't hurt. Who can say the wasp won't sting? But if I drag you through the dirt, darling, so climb in, hold tight, feel the breeze take you high, and the birds on the wings. Somebody gotta push the swing. All climbing, hold tight, feel the breeze take you high, and the bird on the wing, somebody gotta push the swing.
I mess it up. To risk in love is sometimes worth all the uncertainty. So climb in, hold tight, feel the breeze take you high, and the birds on the wings. Somebody gotta push the swing. Maybe a future hit.
Yeah.
The Michael Shelley Show. You never know.
Yeah, great. So how long does it take to write that song?
I don't know. A few hours.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, not too bad.
So how many new songs have you got?
Oh, I've got from going down there and working with several people, I've got a handful we're cycling into the show. You know, this is over like the last 12 to 18 months I've been going down to do that. So I'd say five or six that I'm trying to play myself, and
the rest to sell to Garth Brooks?
Who knows?
Oh,
I mean,
cool.
You know, sometimes you also come out of something and you realize you like the person, but the time, you know, you end up with half a song and, you know, maybe it gets finished or maybe it doesn't. Like, some of the process also just seems to be like practice or exercise. It's almost like you're just keeping the creative muscles sort of limbered up. And so, you know, when you walk out of one of those sessions and you don't have the hit song, you're like, oh, well, at least we were engaged.
Yeah, I think that part of the process is the missing.
Yeah.
I talked to J.D. McPherson, and he said that he did try to write a song with Nick Lowe, and they went out to lunch after sitting there with guitars for a little while, showing each other cool things.
Right.
So you want to get some lunch, and yeah.
And that was it. Well, you know, it's funny. I love, there's a story about, I think it's Donnie Fritz and John Prine wrote a song together a while ago. And they went and they were hanging out. I don't know what time of day it was. Let's say it was early afternoon. And they probably, you know, had a cup of coffee and chatted for a while. And then they realized nothing was happening, so they decided to go bowling.
Yeah.
And then after bowling, they got something to eat. They went back. They finally worked on the song. Yeah. It's like, you know, it is a lot of hanging out and sort of just talking about things and sort of figuring out what you have in common with someone. So anyway, it's a different way to do it.
It's also very much the Nashville way for the past 25 years or so. It just everyone meets up in these little rooms, and it's very businesslike and whatever.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, mixed results, mixed results. So we don't have that much time left.
We don't.
So I don't want to play a record unless we have to.
No, we don't.
We could. Tell me, tonight in Hopewell, New Jersey, at this beautiful Hopewell Theater, whose musicians will be with you?
Mark Spencer and Jimmy Ryan will be with me. Both guys that I've played with for a long time. And
both guys were in a fantastic band.
The Blood Oranges.
The Blood Oranges, who, and they, I mean, Mark's played with a million people.
He has.
Sometimes on television.
Yeah, most recently with Sunvolt. I think he was on tour with Sunvolt for most of this year. And Jimmy also is stalwart of, like, Boston's...
And they both sing.
Yeah, they both sing, so we'll be doing all kinds of stuff. We may do something like this. I'm going to play, since we're back in old stomping grounds, Amy Rigby tune.
Oh, great.
Don't break a heart that needs you. Turn your back on someone will make you
sorry to make you do that without warming up early in this morning, but you hit the high notes. That's one of those songs that there's like, of course, you know, it's just like, why didn't someone else write that song before? But, you know, and that's the great thing about songs is that there's continually those kind of songs that you're like, how did this not exist?
Right.
You know, before Amy wrote that one. I mean, of course.
Yeah, no, I love that song. From the second I heard it, I think even before she put out The Diary of a Mod Housewife and I was a fan of hers from The Shams and from around New York City. So I just, I knew when she came, you know, even first started playing songs like that, that she had stuff up her sleeve and she was going to, you know, have a bunch of songs that were going to be great.
Yeah.
And I still can't wait to hear, you know, new Amy stuff. So, but I also still love singing and playing that song. You know, it's been a while. We put it out a long time ago, but, you know, it still gets requested. And
that's
so
great.
It's a cool one to do.
Yeah, I think we've had Amy, she sat in that chair, sat in that same microphone. She's been on the show a few times. And I think, I mean, this is my own interpretation, part of why Amy wrote those great songs was because she gave up and started over. It's like, well, screw this. Then
sure.
I'm just going to do what I want to do, and I'm just going to write all the mean things I'm thinking. And
Right. Yeah, shit. No, I think you do. Well, that's probably...
You hit the wall, you bounce back.
Yeah, and also just letting go of whatever's kind of self-conscious or sort of conscious intentions sometimes you have about us. You know, maybe sometimes you have to clear all that stuff away to really...
It's not easy.
It isn't easy because you often are like, oh, I have this cool thing. Cool... chords that go together. It's like, well, it's not going to mean anything unless you manage to pair it up with something that, you know, that expresses some kind of emotion. So anyway, I don't know.
So you put out this first record where you didn't hear the story because you were on the past train, but I was walking down to my bartending job at probably 4 o'clock and I would get the mail and there was a package from J. Sherman Godfrey who produced it. And so I walked into the bar, put the CD in, took the chairs off the tables, you know, and started moving the glasses around and unlocked the door. And by the fourth song, I was like, oh, boy, they did it. You know, it was just, like, so good. I remember calling Jay. I was like, oh, my God, like, boom, you did it. Like,
I know.
You
we're
guys
still
are
proud
on
of that one.
1990, right?
No, 2000.
2000.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. No,
yeah.
I mean, it's only 10 years
it's
off.
It's only 10 years off.
I knew there was a zero.
Yeah.
2000. So, and then it's been an amazing career with, you know, putting records on a Matador, getting signed, being on some different labels, having managers, having booking agents, trying to keep a band.
Not having those things.
Right. Not having, trying to, you know, keep a band together and trying to, you've done a, you know, opening for a really wide range of people playing shows as a headliner. And I've really seen you put a lot of time and effort into this idea of like trying to figure out different ways to keep spread the word, to try to build the audience, to keep yourself involved and interested in a bunch of shows recently at Sid Gold's or a bunch of shows. You've been doing runs of shows.
Yeah,
you know,
we try to... I mean, I think...
Adding different instruments.
The whole... I mean, well, ultimately, you just want to keep doing something that's, you know, playing music. So, you know, and if that means, like, you know, we didn't have any a new record out, per se, this year. So I did the series of shows at Sid Gold's. It was all states of country, which I hope to do some more of in 2018. And those were really fun. They were maybe the funnest of my shows this year, even though they featured very little of my own original music. But it was cool to focus on, you know, great writers from different parts of the country and really think about different places and songs that make you think of those places sometimes, too. That was just... cool and fun thing to do, and maybe like the latest little thing to keep me interested in you know wanting to show up and play live and like get the band together. And you know there's a little bit of that goofy, like, you know, Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, like, kids are gonna put on a show, you know. So but I do feel like and I've continued to have this desire to perform, and you know you have to figure out different.
But I like that it evolves, and as a fan,
yeah, it has to evolve. You know, I mean, I have an 11-year-old kid in school, so I can't travel too much. I can't, you know, so there are things that my time's limited to do, but then there are other things you can, you know, you have to find the other things that sort of, you know, fit your schedule and your life at the moment. So.
You get props for not giving up and for staying creative and
Thank you. Evolving,
which not everybody does.
Thank you, Michael.
I'll take them. Your latest record is live at the BBC performances, right? This is your latest
release?
Yep,
it is. It is. It was, that came out last year.
I have it on vinyl.
Yeah,
but
so you're so cool. we collected a bunch of stuff from traveling to England to play, got a lot of opportunities to play live on the BBC. So that is our most recent record, and I was really proud of it because it was sort of like a little time capsule of, you know, about a 5-year period where I went to England every single time I could, or to the UK or whatever, to build a career there, and got a lot of great opportunities. And I hadn't realized until a few years had passed that, you know, I had all these DAT tapes in my basically in the basement with stuff, you know, but with these, you know, John Peel and Bob Harris and all this stuff. So it was a really great fun to go back through that stuff and find things that could make a record.
Yeah. So, your website is laurakantrell.com, I believe.
It is. And, you know, Michael, I just want to say real quick, we're playing nearby a week from today in your stomping grounds, Montclair, at the Outpost in the Burbs.
We did mention that earlier, yes. Outpost in the Burbs on the 16th, and this tonight in Hopewell, New Jersey. Wow, there's the music. Well, you know what
it
that
came
means.
So quick, Michael.
Boy, it went fast. When two goofballs just start yapping, it goes fast. Laura Cantrell, thank you so much. Tonight at the Hopewell Theater in Hopewell, check today's playlist for links to her website. And thanks to Narvel Feltz, also a link to his website on the playlist for today's program. Don't forget that Graham Gouldman today on Todd's show. Don't forget Ronnie Hawkins on my show, January 6th, January 13th, Ricky Riccardi from the Louis Armstrong House and Museum. Rex is next. Thanks, Laura. This is fun. Come back soon.
I will.
You can come back anytime.
Any old time.
Yeah, we barely scratched the surface. I mean, really, honestly, we did. Yeah.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Good night.
I want to remind you folks, this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockin' County 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org.